Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. Well, you know, my favorite pleasantly provocative and curiosity-inducing question is, Did you know? My friend Caroline Casey loves to ask the question, did you know? And I've kind of adopted it. So, did you know that there were 54 years of peace and friendship between the Mayflower Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Indians in Plymouth Colony between 1621 and 1675? Did you know that? You didn't. Well, neither did I until I met this week's guests, Connie Baxter Marlowe and Andrew Cameron Bailey. When I met them about 10 or more years ago, they told me the inspiring story of how visionary leaders of these two very, very different cultures met and worked together to maintain an intercultural exchange that became what Andrew and Connie call the first great synthesis between Europeans and American Indians. While many, including my own book, Spontaneous Evolution, credit the Iroquois Nation with many of the ideals and structures of governance that inspired our constitution and system of government, Connie and Andrew offer compelling evidence that many of these seeds of freedom came from the pilgrims themselves. Connie should know because Connie Baxter Marlowe is a descendant of the Mayflower Pilgrims, John Alden and Priscilla Mullins, known as America's first couple, made famous by the poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Connie's great-grandfather, James Finney Baxter, was a historian of early New England and president of the New England Historical Genealogical Society. Connie brings a unique perspective to her ancestors' dreams for humanity in that she has spent 30 years in close association with visionary Native American elders throughout the United States and Mexico. And she's been creating forums for them to share their understanding of the nature of the universe for over 20 years. Andrew Cameron Bailey calls himself a Latter-day Pilgrim. He sailed across the Atlantic and arrived in America on Thanksgiving Day, 1969. He was born in England. He grew up in South Africa among the Zulus. He has degrees in science, English, and social anthropology. He was a chemistry professor before coming to the United States. After meeting Connie in 2003, he became disturbed at the level of misinformation in the American psyche surrounding the settling of New England and the ongoing deprecation and denigration of the Pilgrims and the Puritans. And so he is the author of the 21st century historical mystery novel screenplay, The Mayflower Revelations, in order to set the historical record straight in an entertaining, enlightening, and inspiring way. So we're in for a very interesting conversation. Welcome, Andrew and Connie.
Hey, Steve. It's very good to hear your voice.
Hi, Swami. Nice to be back on your show.
Very good. Yeah, it's been 10 years, but what's 10 years in the history of the entire universe? So let's jump right in.
I'm going to correct you on that. I'm sorry. It's been 12 years. We met in 2007 in Santa Rosa, California at Harmony Festival. So that, if you see, we're trying to we're trying not to let on how old we are becoming, but that's what happens as time ticks by.
Our audience will have to conclude that we're all at least 12 years old. So that's good. We're almost mature. that's right. And then you were on my other radio show in 2009 or 2010.
Yeah, so. We came by the house and we actually interviewed you for a film we were doing in your Swami outfit. So it's beautiful. The one on the subject of the
death and rebirth of the American Dream, yeah, the foreclosure crisis.
The foreclosure crisis, right. It's been
quite all know about that.
Yeah, we do.
We all know about that. Well, before we get into the foreclosures, let's really talk about the deep history. What about this? I love that you call this revised revisionist history of the pilgrims and the native population. How did you discover it, Connie, and why is it important right now?
Well, what I discovered was, frankly, the spiritual alignment of the Mayflower Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Indians they met. Because of my time with the visionary elders who had come into my life over the 20 to 30 years that I was seeking the missing pieces of our paradigm, I saw the similarities between the pilgrims who were living an inspired life, a spirit-guided life. They were taking their orders from a higher place, and that is how the Native Americans live their lives. They live in alignment with the Creator, with the Divine, with their conscience. And this was what the Mayflower Pilgrims were seeking, was a society based on the freedom of conscience.
Aha. It's very interesting that they really had these similar sensibilities, probably unlike many of the other European settlers that came to the area. Let's talk a little bit about that story. How did this connection get made, and how was it that they created this lasting connection for over half a century, and then what happened after that?
One thing, Steve, the Mayflower Pilgrims were unique. They were different from the Puritans. They realized they had to separate from the Church of England. That was a treasonous act. These were moms, dads, and kids. These were pastors in the church. These were highly educated people. These were farmers. These were people who knew that the Bible was saying to them, because it had been translated into English, and on their dining room tables, they saw that God intended for us to relate directly to the divine. So they were an unusual lot, very different from the Puritans who came 10 years later. And Andrew will just have a word to say about their meeting with the Native Americans.
Well, and having said that, I personally think the Puritans have gotten a bad rap as well, because their treatment of the Native Americans was pretty close to impeccable, and people are going to be outraged to hear that, but it's a fact. That changed in 1675 when the Indians declared war on the English, and a bloodbath ensued, and that's what happens when you do that. So it's a history that has a very beautiful gem at the beginning of it that then got obscured by subsequent events, which took the form of a pretty brief war. It lasted for about 14 or 16 months. It's known as King Philip's War, and a lot of people think, oh, King Philip, right, that dreadful English king. Well, King Philip was a Native American. He was the son of Massasoit, who is the sachem or sagamore who met with the Mayflower Pilgrims on the spring equinox of 1621, roughly 4 months after the Mayflower people came ashore. They didn't actually meet with any Native Americans until that time. It was roughly 4 months, during which period the Pilgrims had lost almost exactly 50% of their people. 102 people came ashore, and 51 or 52 people survived the first winter. As a result, partly of the harrowing journey across the ocean, the scurvy and the unfamiliar microorganisms in the water once they landed, and on and on. It's interesting. You go back to those early days, and it was frequently the case that a little colonial attempt would come ashore, and half the people would die of diseases, would die of encounters with microorganisms that they were not accustomed to. It went the other way, as we very well know, as well. The Native Americans certainly died of European illnesses, and that actually went both ways as well.
So I'm very interested in this. Now, I've heard of King Philip. I heard of the Native American King Philip. I just really want to imagine this encounter, that here are the people. They arrive on the shores. Half of them are sick and die. There they are, and then they encounter these Native people. Is there any record of what this first encounter might have been like?
Yes, indeed. It was written, it was reported, it was journaled. The writings were sent to London, and they were published as early as 1621 and 1622. What's amazing is that we still have those accounts that were written by eyewitnesses at the time. Pretty remarkable, Steve.
And so how did this connection take place, and what happened then? What was this 50-year period of interchange like?
All right, so let's start with the beginning. The Pilgrims came ashore. They began to build their little village at the place currently called Plymouth, Massachusetts, which back then was the home of the Patuxet, the former home of the Patuxet Band of Wampanoag Indians. Mm-hmm. The Pilgrims, once they came ashore, were running their... They realized before they set foot on American soil that they would have to create some sort of agreement, some sort of document of how they were going to govern themselves. And a document was crafted in the Mayflower before they landed. It's today known as the Mayflower Compact, the agreement that the males on the ship made among themselves as to how they would govern themselves once they landed. So they landed, and every time they had a meeting, they read this document, which is known as the first document of democracy. It's actually the seed of American democracy. There's a very good argument for that. Later on, no question that the Iroquois Confederacy and their constitution had something to do with what then became the American Constitution. So the Pilgrims come ashore, they land on December 16th of 1620. It was an exceptionally cold winter. It was a horrific thing to do. They were months late. They needed to land in September, not December, and they lost half their people as a result of that. So it was tough, it was tragic, and there was nobody there when they landed. Now, this is interesting. You would think that the Mayflower would have landed and there would have been local people there, but there were not. Just a few years prior, in 1614, the famous John Smith had done a mapping expedition around Massachusetts Bay, and he described roughly 2,000 warriors who were resident at this place called Patuxet, currently called Plymouth. He renamed the place Plymouth, and he reported back to his boss back in England that there were an awful lot of terrifying warriors there, and it wouldn't be easy to settle. Something happened in between, and this is critical to the way it unfolded, because an epidemic of disease took the East Coast Native Americans out, the coastal Indians. This was a critical piece of history that very few people understand. A week ago, we had a friend visit us here at Sunrise Ranch in Colorado, and we mentioned this fact, and he said, oh, yeah, that was the smallpox blankets that the Mayflower brought, right? No, it wasn't. The epidemic occurred between the years 1616 and 1618. It was not smallpox, and the Mayflower arrived at the end of 1620, so it is utterly impossible that the Mayflower had anything to do with the disease. However, there was a pandemic of European disease that took out the coastal natives. What happened? I refer you to the book, the Mayflower Revelations, our other book, where there's a full-blown, rather academic white paper on the subject of what happened, simply titled Pandemic. And this is critical to an understanding of what actually occurred and why the Pilgrims were able to survive, and why the English who came later, the Puritans, who came to Salem and Cape Ann and eventually Boston, why they were able to settle there. Because had they come back when John Smith did his mapping expedition in 1614, the place was heavily populated. Now it was almost completely depopulated. Why? What happened? What happened, Steve, is that there was a war, and the war was between native tribes. And the war was for control of the French, so you can blame the French. It was for control of the French fur trade. And conflict broke out between several groups of Native Americans over control of the fur trade. And the Massachusetts natives got involved in that and got themselves in very big trouble because the natives up north had something the southern guys didn't have. The southern guys got around on the water in hollowed-out logs, dugout canoes, called Mishoons. Up north, they got around in birch bark canoes, which is kind of like the difference between an F-16 fighter plane and a biplane back in the First World War. No comparison, night and day. So when the warriors began to come down from the north and attack the coastal natives, there was just nothing much the locals could do. They'd just appear out of the mist, and this was not something they'd ever experienced before. Secondly, and this is my personal theory, and I think it holds up, those warriors were carrying a disease, and that disease came indeed from the French up north and was delivered coastally in the context of this hand-to-hand combat, this bloody war, and the disease was in fact plague, the famous Black Death. And I kind of knew that. I knew it wasn't smallpox. It wasn't many of the other diseases that have been suggested. But bubonic plague is delivered, as most people know, through the vector is rats and fleas. You have to be bitten by fleas that have bitten rats carrying the disease, and that's how it jumps to human beings. That is obviously not what happened. You couldn't have that many rats in birch bark canoes. You couldn't have. It just happened too quickly. 14 months, the population was wiped out. Turns out there is, to this day, another form of bubonic plague. Same bacteria, but transmitted in a different way. It's called pneumonic plague. And that is the source of that famous coughs and sneezes spread diseases. It's an old English little rhyme.
Yeah.
Right? Not kidding, because that's what took out 60% of London back in the mid-1300s. Over a 16-month period, 60% of London died when the plague finally reached London. It started in China. It took centuries for it to make its way across to the English Channel on the French side, and it took a long time to get across the English Channel. In, I believe it was 1348 and 1349, it took root in London, and in the context of a malnourished population, and this is key, malnutrition results in plague going pneumonic instead of bubonic. It's different. And if there's anyone who understands, this is actually, I've passed this by the Centers for Disease Control, one of the senior people there, and he really likes the hypothesis. He personally, by the way, believed it was. Yeah, go ahead. I may be going on too long on this subject.
No. We're going to have to take a little break. But when we come back, we're going to talk more about this amazing new story that's very old. This is Steve Behrman. We're with on WikiPolitiki, and we're talking about the revised revisionist history of the colonies in this country. We'll be back shortly.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years. delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wound, sir?
911, what's your emergency?
My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, Steve Behrman, we're back with Connie Baxter Marlowe and Andrew Cameron Bailey. We're talking about the Mayflower landing and how things unfolded rather synchronously and magically for the pilgrims who landed. We were talking about this mysterious disease that wiped out many of the native tribes along the coast. It was not the smallpox from the blankets. That was an anachronism. It was very likely the pneumonic plague, which was basically spread by coughing and sneezing to population that was already malnourished. So first of all, the pilgrims land. They landed December. They were expecting these fierce warriors, and nobody's there. What happened over the course of the winter, and when? How long was it before they met the native peoples of the area?
All right, Steve. So I think the critical point is here that the place was depopulated. There were signs of human habitation. There were unburied skeletons. There were, had been people there. It was obvious, but they met no people in Patuxent or Plymouth itself. However, in the first week, they first stopped at present-day Provincetown, Cape Cod, Provincetown, went ashore and did some exercise. They had a rather continuous with the greeting took the form of a shower of arrows, and they attacked. A good fire drove off the Indians, and fortunately, nobody was killed. I don't think the injured. So first encounter that we did not meet another Native American until this spring equinox of 1621, roughly 4 months after they landed. And what happened is they were building their little village, what became today's Plymouth City in Massachusetts, and they had a number of small houses under construction. They had some roofs, they had some shelter. They'd had a very, very rough winter. As I'd said, they lost roughly 50% of their people, and you can imagine the grief and the horror of this situation that landed there. There was nothing you could do. The Mayflower was sitting out there in the harbor, was going to return to England, and you would think they would just want to get on that boat and get the hell out of there, but they didn't. They stayed the course, and on the spring equinox, a tall, beautiful Native American came strolling into their camp and totally astonished and alarmed them, as you can imagine. But he just came, he had his hands out in front of him, and he said two words to them, and check these two words, Steve. The words were, "Welcome, Englishmen." Okay. He turned out to be from present Maine. He lived on Monhegan Island. He knew many of the English sea captains there, the fishing captains, and he had a rudimentary grasp of the English language. And I think he had been sent, his name is Samoset. And Samoset may be it's not an Algonquin name, so he may well have been called Somerset. That has come down to us as Samoset. He may have been given the name because it was a common practice for the natives to be given European names. Anyway, Samoset comes walking into camp, sits down with them, spends the night with them, and gives them a lot of information, but his English is really compromised. So Samoset says to them, look, I'm going to go. There's another. I have a friend who speaks much better English than I have. He has spent many years living in England. He's about the equivalent of 46 miles away. It'll take me 5 days to get back. I will return with this man. The man he returned with, and he did, he was true to his promise. He came back with a Native American who spoke fluent English, the famous Squanto. Stephen, have you heard of Squanto?
Ah, of course, yes.
So now here's the miracle of miracles. A Native American who speaks very fluent English, who likes the English, who, however, we don't know how he got to England. He may have been kidnapped. He may have gone on an adventure. It's hard to know. You know, there were boats coming and going, and sometimes and people were kidnapped, and sometimes people said, hey, I'll go with you. Can I come? You know, that's just normal. So he had gone and spent, it seems like possibly 5 or 6 years on at least 2, if not 3, separate occasions where he was in England. Squanto was the magic man because he was the, you could call him the voice of the English. He was the one who brought Massasoit and roughly 90, I think it was 60 warriors the first time, Massasoit and his brother, Quatequina, and another 60 or 70 warriors to meet with the pilgrims. And on that very first meeting, they sat down and they crafted a 6-point mutual protection agreement, a treaty, a peace treaty, that held for 54 years. Now, that is just about unprecedented in indigenous Anglo or indigenous Euro relations. It's just, it's extraordinary. And then as a result of that, and then several things occurred. One is that Massasoit himself became ill just a year into their residency there. And they received word that Massasoit was dying, and they sent 2 Englishmen to go and say farewell to him. And they arrived, and it's a long and dramatic story. They went 46 miles deep into Native territory. They had a couple of muskets with them, but, I mean, the 2 of them could have been wiped out in no time flat. They got to Massasoit's encampment to learn that he was still alive, and he was suffering. He was in dire straits. But they knew what to do. They had brought with them, they called it a physic. What's the other term, Connie?
Conserve.
A conserve. It was simply an herbal conserve that Massasoit's jaws were clenched so tightly they had to pry his jaws open with a knife and get this conserve into his mouth, onto his tongue, and wouldn't you know it, he recovered completely. And when he recovered,
wow,
he made a speech to the effect that I now see that the English truly love me and I will honor my relationship with them for the rest of my days. And he did. From that day in 1622, I think it was, to 1662, when he passed away, there was peace and friendship between the natives and the English. Okay. And it held. And it was actually, there are current archaeological excavations going on that are showing that there was a very close relationship. They lived in close association. It wasn't like an apartheid situation. This is whites only and you Indians are over there. They lived in close association. They traded. They worked together. They played together. They exchanged everything from recipes to, you know, stories about how to grow your crops, whatever it was. And I'm going to hand this over to Connie right now because I'm doing too much talking, my darling. Here she is.
Well, Andrew's great in the details. And I'm more into the philosophical, inspirational aspect of this whole thing. So one thing that Andrew didn't get to, and that is the first Thanksgiving. You know, that's jumping ahead a whole nother year. But I think it's important for people to know that the first Thanksgiving was within this context of this peace and friendship. It was, in fact, 3 days of intercultural celebration, playing games and a feast because it had been a good harvest. So it's everything we dreamed the first Thanksgiving was. It's just that the story was out of balance because we only had this mythologized Indian Squanto, the pictures and everything. We left out the beauty of the native ways and the beauty of the native people and their culture. So that's how this whole story has swung from being out of balance in the beginning by leaving out the Indian, glorifying the pilgrims, which they in fact deserved, And then the pendulum swung over here to where it's demonizing the pilgrims to honor the Indian. And so we're in a fix right now because we haven't had this story in balance. And so what we're doing with our perspective of this synthesis that occurred between the Europeans and the Native Americans is to take us up and out into an inspired place for the future so that we can come together in our hearts in the future and give birth to something, a new synthesis.
You know, there's no sin in synthesis, by the way, and no harm in harmony. So it's good that we know that. And it's really important to bring the whole picture.
Mommy.
We don't want to – I can't help it. We don't want to demonize anybody. Tell us more about, Connie, about your connection with Native tribes and Native teachings. How did that come about, and how did you discover and uncover your own family history and begin to weave this together with the Native Native culture?
Well, as far as my family was concerned, it was always kind of rumored that we were Mayflower descendants, but it wasn't a big deal in my family. My family were very conscious of the American democracy and participated as visionary politicians and philanthropists and all that. I could go into that, but I won't. And but the whole Mayflower thing was very downplayed. And as far as the natives coming into my life, I was looking for the missing pieces of our paradigm. I felt we were out of balance, that we were not bringing the love, the true love in the human heart, into our relationships and into our governance and into our way of life. And the answers you get depend on the questions you ask. I went looking and looking, and what came to me to answer my question was these visionary Native elders. And through them and their way of life, I saw what I consider to be clues to the true nature of the universe. Their understanding of the interconnectedness and sacredness of all things, their understanding of true freedom, what it's like to truly be free. And that's what this nation is founded on, is this notion of freedom. Okay, so what we're evolving into is a higher concept of freedom than what we have put into play in our cultures and in our societies to date. We are in process, and the Native people are carrying key clues to how to set ourselves free and become what the Mayflower Pilgrims dreamt for humanity, what the founding fathers of this nation dreamt for humanity, that we could do this thing. And we feel, Andrew and I, that it has to do with moving into trust. In God we trust. We've written a book called The Trust Frequency, 10 Assumptions for a New Paradigm. And this is the foundation of how we get from here to there. We understand. We have a new understanding of the nature of the universe that is being carried in the indigenous cosmology and way of life and in our own hearts and spirits.
So we're really going to get into that and your platform that you call the American Evolution, which we'll get to in the final segment. I also want to hear a little bit more about how the pilgrims how their worldview seemed to mesh and blend with the Native American worldview.
Well, I would say because the Native worldview is creator based, it's a trust based paradigm. Okay, they go on the hill, they cry for a dream. The universe speaks to them. Something speaks to them in this time. They come down. They tell the tribe. The tribe says, cool, let's do it. Nobody has to prove anything. They know that this person has been spoken to by the divine energies. Okay, the pilgrims were in the same place. It was epiphany-based. If you had an epiphany, you had a contact that said, hey, do this, go there, this is what it's all about. You were honored and respected, and you were followed. You became part of the movement. So this is the human human making the direct contact to the unseen forces of the universe, okay? This is where we are shut down. We are not in contact. We are our systems and our way of life is predicated on man-made laws that are contrary to universal laws. We've lost that connection, and so that's what I see, because I live a spirit-guided life. I am told what to do by the energies on the planet. And so I could recognize it in the pilgrims, and I have understood it through the native people. You know, you have an appointment with a native person. Well, if he shows up, he shows up, because he's living in alignment with his alignment with the divine energies. If he's supposed to be there, he'll be there. If he's not, he's not. Okay, this is just a completely different way of life, and it has been being connected to those and living accordingly.
You know,
and Steve, let me add something. Yeah. A passage written by a man named Edward Winslow, who was both a Mayflower passenger and he was kind of the ambassador to the Native Americans. He's the one who went to Massasoit when he was dying and brought along with him the conserve. And one of the conversations that he recounts in a little book that he published in 1622 called Good News from New England, and the book was written with the intent, I think it downplays some of the tougher aspects of how difficult it was, because they wanted to recruit more people to come over and join this budding colony. But Connie, are you looking for the?
Yeah, but I can't.
It's not there. Okay. Anyway, in a little booklet called Good News, N-E-W-E-S, News with an E, Good News from New England, by Edward Winslow, is this beautiful little passage. Connie, can you recount some of that? You remember about Khitan?
Well,
it's quite lovely. So what happened is they spent the night with this Native American encampment, with a man who was the leader of the Indians was pretty anti-settler. And the first thing the man said to Winslow was, how do you dare to come among us, to come this far into Indian country? How do you dare to do that? And he said, well, so upright is mine heart unto you, when love, how does it go, Connie?
Where there is love, there is no fear. And mine own heart is so upright towards you, I am fearless to come amongst you.
Yeah. And then, so that was the answer to that question, and it's rather beautiful. And then the Corbitant is the man's name. He said, what are you doing? We're about to eat, and you guys are doing something rather strange here. And what they were doing, of course, is they were praying. They were saying grace. And as they said their grace, the Indians wanted to know what this was about. So they then proceeded to explain how that everything that they received was given to them by God, and they gave thanks, and then they ate, and they gave thanks again for the healthy food they had received. And the Indians listened to that, and they thought it was very much in parallel with exactly their understanding of the nature of the spiritual nature of the universe. And they said the only difference is that we, two things. One is what you call God, we call Khitan, K-I-E-H-T-A-N is the way it's been spelled. So they had a concept of a God being named Khitan. And they said, we only really have one problem with the philosophy you just explained to us, and that's the one about only having one wife. What's up with that? They actually had a hard time with that. They thought it was cool to have a number of wives. So that was the difference. But that's not a cosmologically – it's not as significant cosmologically as the fact that they both agreed that their bounty came from a divine source and that they gave thanks to that source.
Wow, what a great way to end this segment. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with Connie and Andrew to talk more about the trust frequency and where we can take this amazing story from here. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki, we're back soon.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Wow. Well, now we're back once again for kind of a final wrap-up segment to bring this story of the past into the present and future. We've been talking about the remarkable story of how the native peoples and the pilgrims found, other than the number of wives they could have, found a common spiritual connection. Very powerful. So how do we take this into the next century? I love the idea of the trust frequency. You know, and in studying a little bit Qigong and Chinese medicine, I believe it's the spleen that is the organ where the detriment is worry, and the antidote is trust or faith. So somehow, in our Western world, we've gotten so used to the idea that we humans control things, and because we really have experience of controlling very little, worry is really an epidemic amongst us. And so trust may be the antidote. How do we bring this new trust into a world that is right now perhaps less trusting than it's ever been?
Well, Steve, we'll tell you. We feel that it takes us, that we must shift our core assumptions about the nature of the universe, that we do not understand how the universe works, and therefore we are mired in duality, in victim, perpetrator, in shame and blame, and worry. And our book, The Trust Frequency, 10 Assumptions for a New Paradigm, which is informed by indigenous cosmology, quantum science, Eastern and Western mysticism, and plain common sense. Mm-hmm. Okay, we bring forth a construct on the nature of the universe that lets us see that we are loved by a conscious, loving, abundant universe, and that we can walk in trust of that. And once we accept these new assumptions about the nature of the universe, we can actually embody it. We can live it. We can walk it. We can know that everything serves a higher purpose. This is very indigenous, that everything has a purpose. And we know that everything that happens in our life happens for us, not to us. I'm going to give it to Andrew.
You okay? All right, I'll pick it up there, Steve.
Steve, I just opened the book because I remembered something at the beginning of the book. We have some testimonials. Here's a testimonial from Marilyn Youngbird. She's a Native American elder and Arikara Hidatsa tribal elder and an international holistic health teacher. She says about the book, and the book, of course, is The Trust Frequency. She says, "This book brings a wonderful gift to the human race. Thank you for bringing the spirit of the truth at the heart of the indigenous way of knowing in such a loving manner." And I'm going to read the next one, and you might recognize this one, Stephen. "The Trust Frequency takes on the great evolutionary, visionary, and practical task the authors refer to as the radical reinvention of our species. Weaving together ancient indigenous wisdom, the wisdom of our own Western tradition, and modern scientific understanding, this book is a key tool in the evolutionary upwising we are experiencing today." And that is from called Steve Behrman, a.k.a. Swami Beyond Ananda. That was, I read that from our book, Steve.
It was around, I do remember your book, and that was my take 10 or 12 years ago when I wrote that. However, and of course, I was just about to say that we're looking for the signs of the upwising where we are right now. So, you know, the fact that this book, we're now 10 or 12 years down the line, how do you see this being received? What might the psychological obstacles be? And what are the signs that we're actually going to make it? So it's a complex question, but I think we can cover all three of those.
Well, I'm back. I had a little coughing fit. But what I want to say is, and to tie it into our previous conversation with around the Native Americans and the synthesis that occurred between the European colonists and the American Indian in Plymouth, and then another one that occurred with the Iroquois Great Law coming into the Constitution, aspects of it, which you're very familiar with. We call that the second great synthesis. And what, from my knowing, is going to happen is a third great synthesis, that we're coming into alignment with the Native people. The climate crisis has opened our hearts and minds to welcoming in the caretakers of the earth and what they have to bring to us and our consciousness. So for us, this is a forward-moving trust frequency evolution into this higher frequency where there's more abundance than we can fathom. The laws are expanded, and this is the reality that John Lennon describes in Imagine, and the Native Americans know in their heart of hearts and are bringing to us through their wisdom and knowledge and connection to the unseen forces of the universe.
Could you quote Henry David Thoreau on that?
Yeah. So Henry David Thoreau says, as far as what happens when one actually walks in trust, and America, you know, this conversation is a lot about the United States, and on our coins we have "In God We Trust," okay? That's a Christian way of saying that in Creator we trust, in Providence we trust, we walk in trust that something is happening that is higher, headed into trusting our own intuitive knowing and walking in alignment with that. So it's walking out of fear into trust, into a higher frequency where the laws are expanded. So that's what I've got to say on the subject.
And Steve, I was actually trying to get Connie, she's very good, with a certain quote from one of America's great philosophical heroes, namely Henry David Thoreau, who a lot of people don't realize that, but he was one of this country's earliest and greatest ethnographers. He died leaving roughly 22,000 pages of notes in his journals on the subject of the Native Americans and how they lived. And he was especially interested in how they lived before contact, and he was especially interested in how they understood the nature of the universe. But on the subject of trust, Henry David Thoreau, in the conclusion to Walden, has a paragraph, and I'd love Connie just to tell us that. Do you mind?
Okay. Here she is. Okay. Well, Thoreau was a mystic, and he could see what the natives could see, so he wanted to explore their cosmology. But this is in his conclusion to Walden. He said, "Confidence, he will pass a certain, he will experience a success unexpected in common hours. The laws that apply to him will be expanded, or new laws will be made in his favor, and he will live with the license of a higher order of beings. Okay, this is the uprising.
Yeah.
Okay, this
now,
is
you know, if,
the up-
of course, Thoreau also studied the Bhagavad Gita. That was one of the books he took with him when he went to Walden. And he was very familiar with that aspect of the, we might say, the perennial wisdom. So I could see where he would really have the eyes to recognize the kinds of truths that the Native Americans based their entire being on.
Yes, and one thing that it's important, I don't want to close on a negative note, but it's important that Thoreau saw, and we all know, that the Native also has a shadow, that they were incredible warriors, they were extensive war with each other, that they have the dichotomy within their spirit that we have, and that is that there is a light and shadow to all races, that we've all been influenced by this lower frequency energy, and we've all been doing really nasty things to each other, and we all have a light, and that's our work, is to take us into the light together without demonizing one race over another. So I think that's just really important to know that we're all on the same playing field. We've all had the influences, all races, and that it's time now to go forward.
That's really, really important.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah.
Really important to really focus on that, because, as we know, we tend to put somebody or some people up on a pedestal. Then, of course, when you're up on the pedestal, then it's just as easy to take them down. When I think that what we're dealing with and what we're metabolizing right now is this aspect of human, quote-unquote, human nature, where we are susceptible to the illusion of separation. And that's what gets played on by, we like to call them sociopathogens in the body politic. And so I really appreciate you equalizing the playing field by recognizing that each of these civilizations have a light and a shadow, and perhaps in recognizing that both of those exist, we can do better to expand on the light. So in the closing minutes of this conversation, how do we expand on that light and move this trust frequency front and center?
Step one, Steve, let's listen to the indigenous people. They have a 150,000 years of wisdom to back them up. We're a shallow new entity certainly on these shores, and we've brought a lot, and we have a certain amount of wisdom ourselves. But if we could just listen to our indigenous brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers, that would be a darn good start.
But
good.
Also to listen to our own heart, okay, because we're all indigenous. There is a true nature of the universe. There is a true human nature. And you spoke of human nature. I feel that the human nature, we are love, and we came here to love and be loved, and that we have been responding to a lower frequency, that the earth was actually sitting in a lower frequency. It is not our nature. It's our response to a lower frequency, and that the earth is actually moving into a higher frequency. So we are being led to a higher way of being. The energies support us in opening our hearts and in having the systems break down that don't align with the heart and spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're certainly seeing that happen. What if everything that you've seen in the last minute or 30 seconds, what gives you the most encouragement right now? Is there something that you're finding very encouraging?
Well, the World Wide Web and the worldwide peace movement. I mean, never in the history of humanity has all of humanity been able to communicate with each other and stand with each other in their hearts for peace, for unity, for the oneness of all things. And that is happening now. It is a force so powerful that it can't be stopped.
Thank you. Thank you, Connie Baxter Marlowe and Andrew Cameron Bailey, for your insights on the trust frequency. And as Swami would say, instead of pulling apart in the tug of war, we need to pull together in a tug of peace. Steve Behrman for WikiPolitiki, and we'll be back next week.